I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, now in depth on what lies ahead for African lions in the wild. One conservation group estimates that there may be only 35,000 left. Habitat, clashes with humans, hunting are all contributing to their diminishing numbers. The University of Minnesota's Craig Packer has researched and run a lion project in the Serengeti for decades. He notes in a new book that when he first went to Tanzania in 1972, there were fewer than 10 million people there. If population projections are right and millions more occupy Tanzania in the next several decades, quote, you can kiss all of the lions goodbye. So what would it take to stop that? We're going to talk about Craig's ideas, which rile conservationists and hunters alike. Craig Packer is director of the Lion Research Center at the University of Minnesota. He's author of the new book, Lions in the Balance, Man-Eaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. And he's with me in the studio. And it's great to have you here. Welcome. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Carrie.
Yes, as you acknowledged when you came in, you are here on a day when we have news about this Minnesota dentist not facing charges in Zimbabwe over the killing of Cecil the lion. And you said you weren't surprised that there will be no charges. Why?
Well, you know, the way that sort of industry works is that you've got operators who have direct connections with the authorities, and then they have their professional hunters who are beholden to the operators, and then they ferry a client around. And the client is largely in their hands and believes whatever he's told. And so in the case of Walter Palmer, I don't know that in any detail, but if it's typical of most hunting clients, he'll just follow the flow of the culture. And it's the culture in countries like Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Zambia, et cetera, where let's get the trophy. And there's no challenge involved. There's no sport, really. Most of these animals are killed on baits, and it's a clean shot. So humanely, they're being killed because they're not going to be wildly shooting at a fleeing animal. But otherwise, there's really not much ethics to it.
So when you say the culture is let's get the trophy, you mean I want a head to take back to wherever I come from to show that I was able to shoot down a lion. And that's it? And the operators are all making that possible?
Yeah, the shocking fact about sport hunting of lions in Africa, where it still exists, is that largely they're selling dead animals. And so they are advertising their success rate. And so if you were to go to the Safari Club International Convention in Las Vegas or Reno, it alternates every other year, you'll see different companies advertising their success rate. And they want you to have 80, 90% success. And so where's the sport in that? And where's the money? Because these trophies are being sold for very small amounts of money in the big scheme of things. Just to put it in perspective, if you were to want to be a big hunter who went out west in the U.S. somewhere and you wanted to shoot a bighorn sheep, there are some states in the country where every now and then put bighorn sheep on quota, mm-hmm. and there's an auction system. And so people compete, and they'll pay maybe $500,000 to shoot a sheep. Now, with lions, the latest estimates vary. There are between 20 and 30,000 wild lions left, and you're almost guaranteed a dead lion at the end of your safari, and you pay, what, $10,000 to the host government? And overall, you may pay $50,000, $75,000 to the company to go out and shoot the animal. Now, the economics of that are bizarre, and they're totally inadequate to protect these animals in their natural habitat, given all the other slings and arrows that they're prone to. You have tremendous amount of conflict with local people because lions eat cattle. You have tremendous conflicts with local people because lions eat people. And so here you have a species that's very, very hard to live with in the modern world, and there are very few left. And if you're going to try to protect them, you need a massive investment. And sport hunting brings in pennies on the dollar of what's required to do that.
You write about trophy hunting in your new book, and one of the things that you say is some of the emotion could be diffused by accentuating the positive. Trophy hunting is not inherently damaging to lion populations, provided that hunters take care to let the males mature and wait to harvest them after their cubs are safely reared. Now, this is something that makes conservationists really anxious when they know that someone like you believes this. How would this work, and is it working somewhere that you could say, well, that's the model for it?
Well, so despite the cynical corruption in much of Africa, where hunting is allowed on wild lions, there are a couple of countries that are relatively uncorrupt, and there is much more active management of the populations, and the number of animals being shot are being restrained. And so, yes, there is, even though in some cases lion hunting is pretty disastrous for populations, there are exceptions. And so in Namibia and in South Africa, both of those countries, their lion populations seem to be doing reasonably okay. And in both cases, there is sport hunting allowed of wild lions. And in those cases, the amount of revenue that's generated by the activity does make an important contribution. I mean, there was a big controversy a year or so ago when Namibia put on for auction a rhino down at the Dallas mm-hmm. Safari Club. Mm-hmm. And that was sold for like $500,000. And, you know, one can question the ethics of this at all. But the fact of the matter is there was a person who was willing to pay a huge sum of money to kill this animal. And it was an animal that was known by name. It was identified as being post-reproductive. It was too old to contribute to the population. It was just sort of wandering around. And so the Namibian government agreed with everyone, okay, allow this animal to be shot. Now, that was a pretty hefty sum of money. And in rhino, if you kill one rhino, and an old, old male like that, it's going to have no impact on the population whatsoever. Now, I was not entirely thrilled with that because, again, I think that in general, hunting doesn't generate enough money. And I don't know the sums for how much you should charge for a rhino and whether the $300,000 actually was enough to make a difference. But that's in the right ballpark anyway.
Okay, but I want to understand how you – I mean, you still don't seem quite comfortable with the ethics of allowing any kind of trophy hunting. But are you saying to yourself – we're not going to eliminate it. We've got corruption to deal with in these countries, so it's going to happen. So if we were going to manage it and we were going to get buy-in from like the Dallas Safari Club, who I think we talked to a few weeks ago, this is how it could work. The ethics of it still make me kind of squeamish. I mean, is that where you're at?
That's basically my position, yes, because, you know, I started thinking about sport hunting of lions about 10 years ago and had been going on for decades. And I just accepted it as inevitable and something that would be very hard to do much about. And also there is a certain appeal to their argument that there are plenty parts of Africa that will never attract a huge amount of photo tourism. There are national parks that are splendid and wonderful, and gate receipts in those parks do generate a fair amount of money, like the Serengeti and Ngorongoro Crater in Tanzania, places in Kenya and South Africa. Those are natural wonders with wonderful wildlife spectacles. But there are plenty of other places which are like what Hemingway described as miles and miles of bloody Africa. It's flat, it's boring, there's lots of tsetse flies, et cetera, et cetera. And if you don't set it aside with some idea of it somehow earning its way, this has been the traditional strategy that wildlife must pay its way, then you're not going to get revenue from phototourism. And that land would most likely, almost certainly, be converted to agriculture mm-hmm. and to cattle ranching. So to protect, or at least to sustain, as much of this other boring wild Africa as possible, sport hunting has been presented as an option.
You quote George Hartley, who owns this safari group out of Houston. You quote him in the book, and he tells you in these discussions about how this might work that it's not going to work unless everybody follows the same rules. Could you, you know, this managed trophy hunting, do you think you could bring on enough conservation groups that would see the value in following the rules more so than just, hey, we pay off government officials and it works for us and we make a lot of money with these people that want to come and we pay what we have to pay to do business? I mean, could you persuade enough groups to get rid of that model and join something managed like you're talking about?
So, okay, you know, what I've described is the status quo, which is this philosophy that has been dominant in Africa ever since independence in the 1960s, that wildlife must pay its own way. And that we can view as a continent-wide experiment in how to sustain natural populations of big, dangerous animals. It had a half a century to run its course. The data are in. We know the results. It doesn't work. Wildlife can't pay its own way. Whether it's sport hunting that only generates a few pennies on the dollar for lions like Cecil, or even where you have photo tourism, if you rely on gate receipts in the Serengeti, where I know you've visited, you get more and more people every year. It's more and more of these circles of cars around every interesting animal. Nobody sees anything. The animals are always being surrounded and harassed. It turns into a dust bowl, and it's still not generating enough money because the park fees can't be as high as they really should because it's an industry like any other, and they have to compete against families wanting to go to Disneyland or Disney World or wherever else, Europe, as opposed to going to Serengeti. So prices are inevitably too low. So wildlife cannot pay its way. That's clear. And we need to see an entirely new model, absolutely different, which says, you know, these areas are world heritage. These are the areas that we most treasure in Africa, worldwide. And these are the poorest countries left on Earth. They can't do it on their own. I mean, what we've done with Yosemite and Yellowstone, have you been to Yellowstone this year?
Yeah, not this year.
Okay, no. You haven't been this
year. Very crowded, right?
Right. But you also are still paying for Yellowstone, even though you didn't go, because your tax dollars are contributing to it. I'm paying for Everglades. I didn't go to Everglades this year, but we're still paying for it. And we agree that that's a worthwhile expenditure.
Right.
But we can afford it from our tax base. It's insignificant within our budget of the American government. But that's not the case in Africa. But do you treasure the Serengeti as much as Yellowstone? A lot of people do. I do. And I think we should contribute to those parks as well. I treasure lions, elephants, rhino, giraffe. All those species are on the way out because there's not enough money going into their management. The model of wildlife paying its own way is a spectacular failure. We need to get the whole world involved. If we think about some of these very famous places, UNESCO has a program called World Heritage Sites. The Serengeti is a World Heritage Site. Gorongoro Crater is a World Heritage Site. Do you know how much money UNESCO puts into those areas?
No. What is it?
Zero. Nothing. So there are plenty of parts of Africa where UNESCO has said, well, let's declare this area, this new area, an additional World Heritage Site. And the host government said, no, no way. We don't want it because you're not going to give us any money for it. And now we can't develop it in any way. So if the world and the host countries agree that some areas really should be set aside, the world should help pay for it.
Craig Packer is with us in the studio today. He's director of the Lion Research Center at the University of Minnesota, and we're talking about some of the ideas that he writes about in his new book, Lions in the Balance. To join the discussion, 651-227-6000. If you're a hunter, maybe you're a trophy hunter, I'd be interested in hearing your reaction to it. What about what he just said about actually investing in the idea of some of these protected sites if the countries in which these sites exist can't do it themselves? 800-242-2828, mprnews.org. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, and to the phones to Jim in Andover. Hey, Jim, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Yes, hi. You know, as a lifelong hunter, and I hunt deer in Minnesota, elk, I have a couple of trophies on my wall. I can tell you that the first thing that any hunter wants to do is preserve the animals that they seek to pursue in the wild. Whether the animal is, you know, held up and shot, or whether some game manager comes in to try to control the population, the difference is whether they generate revenue or they pay money to do it. So I don't want to have the public confuse the issue of whether killing the animals is a good idea and the ethics involved in that. It should be really about conserving the animals for the long term. And we don't necessarily need to do that by creating more exclusive zones where you can't do any hunting.
Because
there's $0 gained when you don't hunt.
Jim, hang out for a minute here. I want you to hear what Craig has to say. And then I'm interested in your reaction. Craig?
So I really like to make the distinction between hunting in North America and hunting in Africa. So folks like Jim are avid conservationists. There are millions of hunters in North America. There are millions of people who really care about the future of the species that they hunt. And These are largely paid for by memberships in citizen organizations, also in taxes. I mean, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service contributes directly to the management of a lot of federal hunting areas that are open for hunters. But these are very different from the Africa model. The African model is that these are businessmen with very close connections to very corrupt politicians in countries like Tanzania and Zambia.
You mean the hunters themselves?
No, I'm talking about the businessmen.
People that are running the...
The operators. So these are basically the people who get the exclusive contract to lease the land from the host government. And then they bring in, they hire professional hunters who then escort the client in to do the hunting. And so they're driven by a very different motivation. It's profit motive. And given the insecurity of a lot of these countries in Africa, they're not sure they're going to be able to maintain that lease for more than a few years. So things sort of conspire to minimize people's interest in the long-term health of the animal populations in these areas. And because often these are people who've been given this land preferentially with an under-the-table payment that's really minuscule, these are not people who have the capital to invest in the management. They can't pay for any poaching patrols. They can't pay for community
So there will be no common good of this arrangement. So, Jim, do you see the... And do you believe the difference between the kind of hunting you're doing and what we're talking about in Africa?
Oh, I believe that Africa is utterly corrupt. I've been there, and I'm with you on that. But I don't think that by saying no more hunting is the correct solution. Let's take, for instance, the wild turkey. The wild turkey didn't come back to the United States because of government action. It came back because of, with the exception of the government saying, hey, we can only take two turkeys this year or whatever. But it was brought back by hunters. And, of course, by and large, all the other species that benefit from the resources and things that are done along that.
Oh, I absolutely agree.
What I disagree with is every time, we have these new monuments put down and everything, they always include no hunting. And the same thing would happen. So if you could convince UNESCO to come in there and supply dollars and still allow responsible hunting to happen, then I would agree with you. But let's not confuse the issues. And there's two groups here. There's the people that say no animals should be killed. Period, and that's who's pushing this agenda also, and of course then there's the people that they don't care about their ethics and hunt, and I despise those people as well.
I think
you on that, but to just blanket say no hunting in any areas is not the solution.
Craig didn't say that, and to be clear here on what you were suggesting with UNESCO, those would be areas where there would not be hunting. Jim said responsible hunting, isn't that true, or would there be some kind of managed hunting there?
Well, what I'm talking about are these core areas, the national parks. There's already no hunting there.
Right.
So it's just financing places like the Serengeti that don't have hunting.
Right.
Kruger National Park has no hunting. Gorgor Crater has no hunting already, but they're not generating enough money to protect themselves. For the areas outside the core national parks, I think there definitely has to be a discussion about what's the best use of the land. And in fact, if Tanzania were not so corrupt, they have the potential of doing something that could accommodate Jim's concerns. In the case of many parts of the hunting areas of Tanzania, these are leased out to private owners or private renters. And in some cases, they're very poorly capitalized. That's, in fact, the norm. And they can't invest in anything. And their business model is based on false finances. They can't support the area because they're not generating enough revenue. But there are also a number of eco-philanthropists, and there are more and more of those who have hundreds of millions of dollars to invest, and they could put the money in. And if they wanted to put in hunting, absolutely, why not? That would be their decision to do. So a public-private partnership would be an ideal solution because this would include the areas outside these core national parks. My primary concern is that the last bastion of all these populations everywhere in Africa are not the hunting areas, it's the national parks, and they're not funded well enough.
You know, Craig, I wonder... I've been wondering since all this news happened with Cecil the Lion whether you thought anything fundamental would change. And when I hear you describe that model and you saw the reaction in this country to this, there was an opportunity for people to say, I'm going to contribute to organizations that are doing kind of precisely what you thought. But news moves on, and I wonder if you think anything you know, fundamental has changed on this.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As I describe in the book, I spent a long time trying to inform regulators about how the dishonesty and corruption in the hunting industry is undermining all these high-minded ideals of trophy hunting, because there's not any money being generated, because too many lions are being shot, that this is very disastrous. And so I went to Washington, and I talked to people at U.S. Fishery and Wildlife Service about this. And I actually, you know, I ended up losing my access to the Serengeti because one of my confidential statements that I made U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was posted on a public website where I named the names of who the corrupt parties were in Tanzania. And then I went to see them anyway, but I said, look, you know, you're the regulators, and I'm not trying to ban lion hunting. In fact, quite the opposite. And I think, again, people like Jim need to understand that if you're really closely following how things work, no two countries are exactly the same. And I would never, ever advise a ban of lion hunting, even lion hunting in Namibia and South Africa, because things are doing fine down there. Mm. But in the corrupt countries, it's been mismanaged. There's a long history of it. But despite all of this, regulatory agencies like U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service often want to take the action of least administrative hassle. And so instead of taking a case-by-case basis, they too are thinking in terms of all at once. And so their preliminary findings about whether to put the lion on the endangered species list was issued last fall, about a year ago. And I was really shocked to find that they quoted me, because I've done the most research on this topic, up and down. But they excised, it's like they redacted anything from my publications that pointed out that hunting was damaging to lion populations. And I was shocked. But I wasn't shocked because Safari Club International, all of these hunting organizations have very powerful lobbying. And so I only go there when I can, and I'm just a scientist. But the Safari Club organization, their idea of lion conservation is often to hire a lawyer.
So it sounds like the answer to my question is something fund. There might have been a lot of awareness as a result of this Zimbabwe situation.
Yes. And in fact,
nothing major has changed. So what is the answer?
So I was just back to Washington a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And I met with the same people at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service complaining about their overlooking the evidence that lion hunting can be damaging to lion populations. And it was like night and day. I was amazed. They were so thankful. I said, oh, thanks for reaching out to us. I was so glad you could come to talk to us. And I said, well, you know, we have a new paper coming out. And actually, we do have a new paper coming out in 2 weeks. It'll be in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. And I can't really reveal too much because of the press embargo, but it does give emphasis on the need to view the lion as potentially endangered in many parts of Africa. Not all, but in some. And so it really would be better if U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did adopt a more nuanced response.
Got it.
Focus on the bad guys, not punish the good guys, right? And they were all over it. Now, I don't know if they'll do it because I left and Safari Club will come back again, you know, the next day. But after the meeting was over, I talked to the head honcho at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This is pretty high up in the Interior Department in the U.S. government. And I said to him, well, you know, not overtly, but I said, well, it seems like you must have come under a lot of pressure since the summer. And he just shook his head and he said, I've had 24,000 emails.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
that's
another thing. So, yes. So right. Although Cecil, you know, and poor Walter Palmer was just the one who got outed, it's not him uniquely. A lot of people do the exact same thing and don't get shamed on public media. But having gone viral like that, having gone public, has perhaps woken up a lot of people to the fact that a lot of people care. And it's not just these hunting operators and a few wealthy clients going out there that
right.
really matter. But public opinion now is very much wanting them to do the right thing.
Craig Packer in the studio with us from the Lion Research Center at the U of M with a new book called Lions in the Balance. We'll continue the conversation, get a look at the latest news, though, now from Phil Picardi. And Phil, what are you watching today?
Good morning, Carrie. The Washington Post is describing as an outrageous injustice the conviction of one of its reporters in Iran on charges including espionage. Iran's judicial judiciary spokesman today confirmed the verdict in the trial of Jason Rezaian, who had been detained in Iran for more than a year. But the spokesman gave no indication of what punishment the Iranian-American journalist could face. He said the ruling can be appealed within 20 days. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is accusing Arab members of Israel's parliament of helping to incite a wave of unrest that's been sweeping the country. He's calling on Israel's Arab citizens to do it, in his words, kick out the extremists among you. In a speech to parliament, Netanyahu also rejects Palestinian accusations that Israel is plotting to take over a sensitive holy site in Jerusalem. Police in Memphis, Tennessee, say a 36-year-old man has been charged in connection with the fatal shooting of an off-duty Memphis police officer. A spokesman says Lorenzo Clark has been charged with felony possession of a firearm. Clark is a neighbor of Terrence Ulrich, who died yesterday after being shot multiple times at a home in a Memphis suburb. Police are not saying whether additional charges will be filed in the case. Ulrich is the second Memphis police officer to be fatally shot in 2.5 months. A Seattle-bound flight from New Jersey has made an emergency landing in Buffalo, New York, after a small fire in the galley. An airport official says Alaska Airlines Flight 17 was diverted to Buffalo at about 8 o'clock this morning. He says a credit card reader caught fire and the crew put it out with a fire extinguisher. There were no injuries among the 184 passengers and crew of five. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News.
A controversy is brewing in northern Minnesota over whether the Cook County Board should recognize Indigenous Peoples Day each October 12th instead of Columbus Day. I'm Kathy Werzer. Listen for that story and all the news on Monday's Morning Edition.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up next hour, more on the news this morning that a Columbia Heights school board member will resign over comments he made about Muslims. That's at 11. We'll also talk about MEA weekend coming up this weekend. And if you're stressing about what to do with kids home for the 4 days, we'll help you with a to-do list.
Support for this program comes from the Shakopee Mettawakanton Sioux community, whose Seeds of Native Health campaign is working to improve nutrition across Indian country through strategic partnerships, research, education, and food access. More at seedsofnativehealth.org. Support comes from the Guthrie's World Stage Series, now playing The Events, a play with music about one community's search for peace and understanding, featuring a local choir at every performance through November 1st. More at GuthrieTheater.org.
Back to the discussion now. Craig Packer with us with his new book, Lions in the Balance, Man-Eaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. Craig, a tweet here from Bruce who says, wildlife refuges and rainforests in the end are only as safe as the locals can make them. Won't that take local arms and will? I mean, you've dealt with that around the Serengeti.
I think one of the big conflicts that I have with a lot of conservationists is that I think that first and foremost, in setting out any of these wildlife areas, you have to look to protecting local people from these dangerous species. We did research in southern Tanzania where we followed up on the deaths of hundreds of rural Tanzanians who had been killed and eaten by lions. And these were cases where the lions sought out people, pulled them out of their houses, pulled nursing babies away from their mother's breast. I mean, it was really horrifying to talk to these poor people. And yet, the wildlife authorities are kind of viewing them as a nuisance, an inconvenience, that in fact the wildlife is important for the country and not the local people. And so you don't win any hearts and minds locally when people are viewed as subsidiary to these very dangerous species. And so Southern Africa, besides being relatively uncorrupt, is much more reliant on fences. And so they completely encircle their nature reserves. Even the Kruger National Park, which is the size of New Jersey, has a fence around it.
Wow.
And so these work. And we've got data, we've analyzed what happens in fenced reserves, and there's no conservation problem down there whatsoever. The rest of Africa, though, lacks fencing. And in many countries, you have conservationists who I think are basically selling a fantasy. They're selling a vision of virgin wilderness. And that virgin wilderness, I mean, the virginity was lost a long time ago. When you have human population growth where the mass of people is going to quadruple every 40 years, And in another 50 to 75 years, Tanzania is going to be the fifth largest country on Earth in terms of its human population. Unless you put fences around some of these places, forget it. It's just hopeless. Because already we know that in the western side of the Serengeti, where there's 600,000 people who live right along the park boundary and there's no fence, they eat themselves about 125,000 wildebeest every year. And that human population is growing at 3.5% per year. So inevitably, that demand on animal protein is going to exceed what the wildebeest population can handle, and it's going to be gone.
So I was reading what you were saying about this idea of fences, and just to understand this, you do mean something like chain link fences,
yes.
Right?
Yes. I mean something that it could be a wall.
It has to be a physical barrier. Okay.
Because you've got, on one side, you've got, yes, as virgin of wilderness as you can hope for. And the other side, it's subsistence farming. It's all agriculture. It's plowed fields. It's villages. And so in agricultural areas, it makes no sense to me to insist that, oh, we need to get people so that they're happy having lions wandering through their backyard. Or, oh, yeah, sure, the elephants, that's a nuisance. Oh, come on, be serious. You wouldn't do that ever in North America or Europe. There are areas where it's more pastoralist. So you have where there's cattle and livestock because it's too dry to farm. And in those areas, the wildlife like to go out and graze on the pastures. And that's an area that's shared between the two different livelihoods. And in those cases, you couldn't put a fence because you'd kill the migration. So there are places where obviously you don't put a fence. And you do have to have some sort of coexistence model. And in fact, one of my, I can't say students because I'm no longer allowed to work in Tanzania, my former students, does have a project in the Ngorongoro Conservation Area where people are allowed to live amongst the wildlife, and that's been mandated by law. Again, that's an inherited situation. That will have to be that way as long as there's wildlife there. And so you have to find some ways there to minimize the losses of livestock to lions, to get people to be more proactive and more positive about these dangerous animals. But then they have to become shareholders. They have to receive payments. They have to have some sort of incentive to put up with these terrible risks. And there are some projects like that that are working so far on a small scale in parts of East Africa. It remains to be seen if they're going to be viable in the long term, because a lot of things are trendy, and it's a great idea to give your Maasai a TV antenna to radio track a line instead of a spear. And that might work for some time, but will it work for 100 years, and will it work to sustain tens of thousands of lions over huge, huge parts of Africa? I don't know.
You know, I have to say, in reading the chronology of your work in Tanzania and being familiar with it, to finish that book and realize that you maybe will never go back to Tanzania to work, what's that? Do you let yourself think about that?
Well, you know, you just said that, and I tingle. I got a chill just then, being reminded that I can't go back. But, you know, life goes on. And I still have a lot of things I want to do. I feel now the most important thing I can do for conservation is to be talking to regulators, as I mentioned, with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, mm-hmm. to be trying to get UNESCO to actually pay for some of these areas. And I can do that from anywhere. Otherwise, I still love watching lions, and I've started a number of new projects down in South Africa, and it's a whole new area. So it's exciting and shining and new for me right now, and there's lots of opportunities. And so the future stretches out ahead.
Here's one of the things. You just said how much you love watching lions, but the thing that I understood about you is that you're not a romantic about lions. You don't view them the way a lot of people who haven't had a lot of interaction with them, you know, is kind of scary but cuddly and cute. And you have no illusions about lions.
They'll eat you and your little dog too. Okay. I mean, these are dangerous animals. And, you know, you have to respect that they earn their living by eating raw meat. And so they are going to do it whichever way they can. And if that means they have to go into people's houses and pull them out of bed in areas where there's nothing else to eat, they'll do it. And when it comes down to their whole lifestyle, you know, the lion is the only social cat. It's a unique species.
I think you call them Democrats in the book.
There's much that I admire about lions in that
small d.
they are egalitarian.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is no huge inequality within the female side of the lion pride. And that's extremely rare in nature. Most social groups are somewhat despotic, where you have like a pack of wolves or a pack of wild dogs, you have the alpha female. She's the only one that has pups. And mongooses and a lot of other species, there's an alpha female, and she's really nasty to all the subordinates. And they are kind of her, it's like the queen bee and the workers. But in lions, every female gets to breed. And the reproduction is kind of up to them. If things are lucky, then maybe something kills their cubs or not. And roughly, they all do about the same. There's no dominance hierarchy. And it's really rather wonderful to see what a truly egalitarian society looks like. It's a lot like hunter-gatherer groups in humans. We have had in our history a time when we were very egalitarian as well. And so lions follow that. They're wonderful in that. But it's not cuddly. It's not because it's like, oh, Matilda, you need to get your share. No, no. It's because Matilda will say, okay, it's my turn. And they're all fighting for it. And they're each such dangerous opponents, even to their best friends and their sisters, that they respect the danger that they represent to each other. So it's kind of a mutually assured destruction that ends up in everybody being more or less the same.
Wow. Who took over the work of the Lion Project in the Serengeti? Because you directed that for how many years did it end up
I directed
being?
That for 35 years. And
you should explain what you were doing with that.
So I was very fortunate, and I was able to take over the Serengeti Lion Project back in 1978. I inherited, it was started by George Schaller, the very famous wildlife biologist who has done more amazing things than most people in five lifetimes. And he was followed by a series of scientists that I took it over and kept it for decades. And so that was going along for a very, very long period of time. And then I was exposed by someone at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to the Tanzanian government, who then found out I was naming the names of the corrupt parties and how very high up government officials in Tanzania were perverting things to do with sport hunting there. And so then I lost my research clearance, and I handed over to a fellow scientist, an American, at Wake Forest University in North Carolina named Mike Anderson, who studies actually the grasses and soils in the same area, but he's now able to look at the lion as part of a much broader ecosystem. And in fact, not only inheriting the Lion Project, but also another study we started in my last years there that we called Snapshot Serengeti, where we've had 200 camera traps, taking photographs, generating millions of pictures, and getting to see where the herbivores are, where the grazers are. And so you have soils at the bottom of the pile. You have the grasses growing on the soils, the herbivores foraging on the grasses, then the lions that eat them. So you have a whole ecosystem view of the Serengeti. And so I'm glad that the project's in his hands and that last sort of holistic approach to the Serengeti study will continue.
We have a question on Twitter here that says, why can't Craig Packer return to Zimbabwe? It's Tanzania that we're talking about, assuming it's because of his work. Have you worked in Zimbabwe? I don't think I know whether you...
No, I've been to Victoria Falls, and it was interesting. That was a few years ago. It was during their hyperinflation, and it was during a period of time where the largest denomination of a bill was $100 trillion.
Oh, my gosh.
And a $100 trillion bill was worth less than one sheet of toilet paper. And so it was very interesting in seeing these very, very ancient vehicles in Zimbabwe. It was kind of like going to Cuba, I imagine, with the really old cars. But that's my only visit there. Otherwise, I work in South Africa and a little bit in Kenya.
And if you could crystallize the mission of the work in South Africa, because as we note, this is fairly new, mm-hmm. What would you say? That when I am finished with this work, this is what I want to have happened.
Well, in South Africa, it's very much more in basic research and ecology and behavior. And so there, we're going to try to set up the equivalent of a Snapshot Serengeti project in South Africa with camera traps and maybe a dozen different wildlife reserves stretching from the Kalahari in the northwest part of the country down to the Lowveld next to Kruger Park, and see the distribution of animals and how it's affected by rainfall and each species affecting the other. And that we'll probably call Snapshot South Africa. And then we also have another idea that we're going to try to actually get in recruit as many tourists who come to these parks as possible who shoot videos. Mm-hmm. If you go on YouTube, you've got amazing things that you see. And those are amateurs, but the footage is good enough. So we actually want to try to collect all that information, assemble it like we did with Snapshot Serengeti, and have a citizen science project, hopefully getting hundreds and even thousands of amateur video of lions hunting together, wild dogs hunting together, because we want to know if they actually coordinate when they hunt. Because some of the things that's really fascinating about these species is, again, outside of humans, is finding evidence that these animals are really aware of the precise decisions their companions are making when they're approaching a prey animal. I see she's going to the right. She's looking to me. Is she waiting to see me go to the left? Do they actually do that? We don't know because it's been too hard. But in South Africa, there's enough tourism. The animals are so tame, including the prey. And we found a number of areas, especially in their winter, which unfortunately is our summer, when it's cold and the days are short and it's dry, and everything happens around the water holes, and you can just sit there and watch four or five hunts in an hour. Oh. And so we want to try to assemble that. And we got a few other ideas in mind as well.
Craig, does South Africa essentially not have a problem with poaching? I mean, they've solved it.
South Africa has a horrific problem right now with rhino poaching, because they, amongst all of the African nations, were the only ones that had been able to protect rhino from kind of ordinary levels of poaching, which were characteristic to the last 4 or 5 years, when suddenly rhino horn is now worth more than heroin. And when you got that level of money driving the demand for these animal parts, it's just as difficult to control that as it is to...
Why, though? I mean, you talked about the fencing, you talked about the way they fund...
Well, if it's
protection, why?
If you're going to get a payoff that's worth several kilos of heroin, then it's worth your while to rent a helicopter and fly it in and also hire a corrupt veterinarian who has the drugs, dart a rhino from the air and land. And so fences aren't going to help that. What you have to have instead is some way to deal with the demand. That's for animal parts. It's the same problem with ivory. That those species now, their parts are so incredibly precious that it's attracted the same bad guys that we see in the cocaine trade, the heroin trade.
You know, what's puzzling about what you just said about the demand is cultural pressure does not seem to work in some places. I mean, this kind of reminds me of what goes on in a country like Japan with dolphin hunting. Cultural pressure does not seem to work, or maybe it's just so slow it doesn't look like it's working.
Yeah. Well, I actually lived in Japan for a while, and I was working in a conservation site that was one of the last unspoiled forests inside a national park in Japan. And I was surprised to see that at the sort of the tourist center there, they had little ashtrays that were made out of tin cans, but the tin cans sold whale meat. And I met with Japan's top conservation biologist. This is some time ago. I met with Japan's top conservation biologist, and I said, that's kind of ironic to be in this precious national park that's completely unspoiled, and your nature center has whale meat tin cans. And he looked at me very seriously. He said, we Japanese have always taken our food from the sea. So, you know, that's 1,000 years of our culture. And, you know, don't expect us to change whale meat, even though we're worried about the land animals here.
And you would say the same for the demand for rhino horn?
Rhino horn, that's interesting, because there is hope for rhino horn, because that might be a fad. That's actually a big thing in Vietnam right now, because there's a huge amount of cancer in Vietnam, largely because of the American action back in the 70s with all those defoliants we sprayed on everybody. Now there's an absolute epidemic of cancer there, and they have no healthcare system whatsoever. And so they're basically relying on magic. And somebody said to them, use rhino horn, it'll cure cancer. And so they're paying a bomb for a cure for cancer.
Craig Packer's book is called Lions in the Balance, Man-Eaters, Manes, and Men with Guns. And you can read about it on The Thread. Craig, thanks. Good to see you.
Thank you
very much.
Very much.